we're living in an amusement park full of news and information.
And the saw. Where's that coming from?
That was my automatic cat feeder. that is now feeding my two cats.
I attempted once to do a completely automated remote feeding schedule so I didn't have to ask the neighbor to come over and feed the cats when we were gone. And I ended up with raccoons on the porch. Hi, welcome to GeekWire. I'm Todd Bishop.
And I'm John Cook.
We are coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we get to report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. This week, our guest commentator is Mike Davidson. He is a tech and media industry veteran, the former vice president of design at Twitter, and the founder of Seattle-based citizen journalism startup Newsvine, which was acquired by NBCNews.com. He now works as vice president at InVision, the digital product design software company. Mike Davidson, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. It's been a while.
It has been a while. You know, we go way back to when Newsvine was based in the basement, essentially, of the Seattle PI building on Elliott Avenue in Seattle.
Absolutely. I still remember we were trying to keep things quiet. We didn't have anything on the door. There was no sign on the door. It was just like Suite 101. And we didn't want anybody to know what we were up to. And then one day, the intrepid young reporter, John Cook, comes down and knock, knock, knocks on our door and says, "Hey, what's going on in here?" And that was the beginning of a long and fruitful relationship.
Yes, I remember that day. And Mike, advice to you, if you don't want to be discovered, maybe don't put your company in the building with a newspaper.
Yeah. That was, in retrospect, that was a big mistake. We just really like trains, so we wanted to be close to the train track. So this was the building that gave us the best chance of being close to trains. But yes, good advice for sure.
I'd love to start just by getting your impressions about what's been happening over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah.
The booting of President Trump from Facebook and Twitter. What are your big picture takeaways from what's been going on?
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say 2015 Mike would have been very surprised by all of this. But 2020 Mike, not surprised at all. 2019 Mike, not surprised. 2018 Mike, not surprised. Like, I am not surprised by the way that this is all ending, because it's been one big slow motion train wreck for the last, you know, 4+ years. You know, the thing that I'm probably most qualified to talk about is sort of like how the social media networks have handled all this, right? Of course, there are a lot of people who are up in arms about Twitter in particular's decision to suspend Donald Trump's account. And I just want to say, as somebody who worked there for almost 4 years, who is in every important executive meeting about a lot of really, really important stuff, let's say, let me just tell you, if Twitter really wanted to ban Donald Trump, they would have banned him a long time ago. He has committed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of violations on the Twitter platform that if he were a private citizen, he would have been banned immediately for. So this was a last resort. This was something that many employees have wanted the company to do for a long time. I wanted the company to do this for a long time. But the company itself is not out to get Donald Trump. If anything, they let him stick around on their platform for too long. So I think in the end, the straw that broke the camel's back was, obviously this terrible event that occurred at the Capitol didn't happen on its own. I mean, it was precipitated by Donald Trump himself, both on TV and on Twitter and on every other network he could get his hands on. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you run one of those networks, if you run one of these private companies, you have to ask yourself, am I okay being complicit in an insurrection of the United States government? Am I okay with that? And I think at the end of the day, the answer to that question has to be no. And so there is no concept of owning a platform and being able to stay neutral about something like that. You can stay neutral about if you're left-leaning or right-leaning. You can stay neutral if you prefer liberal ideas versus conservative ideas. You cannot stay neutral when somebody is using your platform to incite insurrection and overthrow of the U.S. government.
Mike, do you think, and I know you mentioned that your belief was that maybe it came a little bit too late, but can you get inside the mind of Jack Dorsey and explain why he waited until this last moment? You know, there's a lot of pushback saying, oh, of course, now Twitter kicks him off. Trump's leaving and he's not going to be in power as president. And so that's why they did it at this time. Can you get inside his mind and tell us a little bit, having worked directly with him?
Yeah, Jack is a really interesting cat. I like him a lot. He's one of the most interesting people I've ever worked with. I can't get directly inside of his mind. He surprises me a lot, but he's also a very thoughtful person. And let me address, I think, one thing that you asked in that question first, because I think it's really important. Would Twitter have done this if we would be looking at another 4 years of Donald Trump? So if the election had gone the other way and something equally terrible happened like this, would they have done this? And I don't know the answer to that question. I would like to think the answer to that question is yes. I would like with all my heart to think that the answer to that question is yes, but I don't know for sure. I think that is a great question to get a concrete answer from somebody like Jack and somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, because I don't know. Like you're absolutely right to be sniffing around that hole, because it's possible that this did occur because he's not going to be around for very much longer. However, I will say one of the reasons why it took so long is that it opens up so many cans of worms. It opens up a box of worm cans, as they say.
I've never heard of a box of worm cans before.
Yeah. or as a box of cans of worms, I think is the phrase. It opens up a lot of issues, such as, okay, well, we banned his primary account. What happens if he tries to tweet from the POTUS account, right? And so we know the answer to that question now. They shut off the POTUS account. Okay, so what happens if he uses one of his campaign managers to kind of dictate his tweets? What happens then? Okay, we know the answer to that question. Those accounts also got shut down. Okay, what happens if a reporter reports, standing next to him and reports on what he says? What about then? So I think we know the answer to that, which is like, that's fine. A reporter can do that. Okay, what happens if he records a video and tweets it out from the White House account? And I think he just did that yesterday, right? Or was it today? I don't know. All these days are blending together. And that video was allowed to stay up. And I think that the answer to that particular video was conditional upon the contents of the video. That was largely a, hey, stay peaceful. Don't break the law. Don't be violent. Like, that video was almost 100% kind of like dedicated to getting people to sort of like calm down a little bit. I think that's why it stayed up. So it opens up a ton of different issues like that, not just from Twitter, from YouTube, from Facebook, from Amazon. Now you have all these other cascading effects as well, this Parler app, which is supposed to be a competitor to Twitter. It has now been taken off of the App Store, off of Google's Play Store. Amazon has refused to host them. So it was the first domino, essentially, that knocked over a bunch of other dominoes. And we don't yet know the effect of what this decision really will cause.
Mike, let me ask you this. Would you have kicked off Trump earlier? I mean, there've been a lot of things he said or done, Charlottesville, the list goes on and on of a number of things that have been offensive or would violate perhaps the terms of service of a media company like a GeekWire or a New York Times or Wall Street Journal, that you wouldn't allow that sort of language. Was there a moment in time when you can think back over the last 4 years when you would have, with your experience at Twitter, would have kicked him off?
There are so many moments in time that I can't even point to one. I think what I have thought should have been the policy from the beginning was what the policy was the moment before his permanent ban, which was, this was Monday night or something, I can't remember. Twitter basically said, your account is suspended. We're not letting you tweet from it until you remove the offending tweets and promise not to break our terms of service again. If you do both of those things, we'll re-enable your account.
Why didn't they do that earlier? Why didn't they do that in 2017?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think that, they would have been up against accusations of censorship. And perhaps the one thing that, not many people are talking about is perhaps they were afraid of being regulated as well, right? So when you are threatening to reduce the amplitude of the voice of the head of state, the head of state can do certain things to make your life harder. Now, unfortunately, I don't think Donald Trump knows what Section 230 actually is and what it actually does. There's been a lot of talk about changing Section 230. He understands nothing about it. Honestly, the only reason why he is able to even have a voice on Twitter is Section 230.
And Todd, for our listeners, maybe you should give us a primer on what Section 230 is for those that don't know.
So this is essentially part of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, and it gives immunity essentially to publishers that present themselves as mere conduits, mere platforms for others who might have opinions that they could be held liable for as the generators of that content. But the underlying platform is essentially given immunity. And there is a movement to repeal Section 230 or replace it in such a way that the platforms like Facebook and Twitter and others would be held legally liable for the comments made by users on their platforms.
Right. So imagine what this does to a company like Twitter or any social media company. If you all of a sudden remove Section 230, that means they are suddenly liable for every single tweet that appears on their platform. And so if you were worried about damage that might be caused from one of your tweets, which account would you delete first? Probably at Real Donald Trump, right? You know, he doesn't understand the laws, unfortunately, but there are a lot of other ways he could have made life a lot harder for a company like Twitter or a company like Facebook. And I do think that that was somewhere in their decision-making process for sure.
So, Mike, looking forward, what do you think is Twitter's or Jack Dorsey's biggest challenge now that this ban has been placed, and as he now has to navigate 2021, what's the biggest challenge facing Twitter and Jack?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. You know, I think, you know, Jack always says, you know, Twitter exists to serve the public conversation. And it's a, you know, it's a pretty idealistic kind of high-minded way to think about the service. It really is a North Star that he believes in, that he thinks he can help get us towards. And that is the idea essentially that, you know, if we're all acting together and we're all sort of having a conversation with each other, you know, in good faith, then that's how to push our society forward. Now, the problem is if you remove the good faith aspect from it, it all falls apart. It's all well and good to say, hey, Twitter, you know, we used to say we're the free speech wing of the free speech party. That was our philosophy back in, you know, 2012, 2016, free speech wing of the free speech party. So that's all well and good if everybody's acting in good faith. But as soon as people start acting in bad faith, as soon as people try to intimidate people, try to abuse people, try to silence other people on the platform with their bullying, you know, that's when it becomes hard for services like Twitter to really ensure that they are serving the public conversation. The thing that people don't get about free speech is, you know, if you let one person on Twitter abuse 10,000 people, let's say you've got a really, you know, a terrible chauvinistic sexist man on Twitter who wants to abuse every woman in tech he can find, right? And so he's exercising his free speech on Twitter, and he goes and he ends up abusing 10,000 women on Twitter, calling them all sorts of names, doxing them, replying to all of their tweets. Like, he is exercising his free speech. However, he is negatively affecting the lives of those 10,000 women. He is suppressing their speech by virtue of his bad faith speech. And so that's the tenuous sort of line that the company is always trying to sort of figure out how to deal with, is like, who is acting in good faith here? Who is acting in bad faith? Everybody that's acting in good faith, we want you to be able to say, you know, whatever is on your mind, but we can't stand by any longer and let, you know, a small number percentage wise of bad faith actors make the experience on Twitter and the experience in the world be bad for the masses.
But part of that is also having a large diversity of opinion. Mm-hmm. So you do get outraged occasionally. I mean, that's part of the appeal of these social media platforms, is that you go there because you do see that. And so I think that's a real challenge for Twitter as they go forward. I would love your perspective on, I've kind of got this theory that we're splitting into blue state media and red state media, blue state retail and red state retail. You know, it's like, it's almost becoming two economies, you know, and across, you know, where you shop, if you're a Nike customer, you're a certain profile versus, you know, another retailer of shoes. I mean, and I'm curious in the media landscape, how you see that playing out, because it seems to go absolutely against the concept of a broad-based media that does provide an element of truth to a large group of people, so people are informed and can make better decisions for their democracy. So where is this going? Because this seems like an absolute disaster. I mean, you talked about the train wreck of the past 5 years. This seems like a much, much bigger train wreck that's going to cause tons of damage.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a disaster waiting to happen. It is a disaster. Like, it is a disaster that is currently playing out. I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, this all started when cable news started to become popular, right? So when I was, I'm 45, you know, when I was growing up, we used to sit around the TV at 6 o'clock and watch either NBC News or CBS News or ABC News, depending on which anchor you liked a little bit more than the other two, right? And I don't think there was really much of a difference between those three channels. I mean, they sort of, you know, covered things slightly differently, I guess, but they all tried to sort of stay very objective and down the middle. And then as you started to sort of see these cable channels emerge and you saw the Fairness Doctrine. So the Fairness Doctrine was revoked, essentially, saying that, hey, if you're a, you know, if you're a cable news channel, you know, you don't have to devote equal time to Republicans and Democrats. You can just have Democrats on all day, or you can just have Republicans on all day. And so what happened is you had these networks filling these holes. You had sort of Fox News, most famously on the right, saying, hey, we're, you know, we are, you know, our slogan is fair and balanced, but we're essentially, we are here for conservative people. We are here to fill your heads with news that has a conservative slant 24/7. And there are channels on the other side of the spectrum that do the same thing. And so that was the beginning of the two worlds that you're talking about. I can now live in a world where I don't actually need to pay attention to objective fact. I can just pay attention to what people on my side are telling me, right? So that wasn't too bad because people still like exposed themselves to newspapers and the nightly news. Cable news was kind of just sort of like part of their news diet.
And it was still somewhat regulated too.
It was somewhat regulated, yes, yes. But I think when the dam broke is when we started getting most of our news from personalized feeds. I think as soon as that started happening, we really created a billion different worlds for people. Like everybody's world is different because everybody's news feed is different.
I'm curious how you fix that. I agree. How do you fix that though? Because, and I've often wondered like, could there be a new seal of approval or a type of certification that you have to get if you're a certain audience or you have a certain level of followers or you are a true media organization doing journalism? How do you envision fixing that problem? I mean, you're a product guy, a designer.
Let's make that a teaser because this gets into what I think, John, is actually one of the silver linings, a very thin silver lining, but a silver lining nonetheless in this situation. Let's do that right after the break. You're listening to GeekWire.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook. Our guest on the show this week is Mike Davidson, a tech and media industry veteran, former VP of design at Twitter, who now works as vice president of InVision, the digital product design software company. Mike, that question that John asked you right before the break, the issue of the splintering of this entire social media landscape and what you would do essentially to create a better social platform. I think that speaks to one of the opportunities here because for many years, everybody just said, oh, it's going to be Facebook and Twitter and maybe LinkedIn in the business world. I recognize that you're splintering all of these audiences by political philosophy and political doctrine, yet you are seeing people embrace platforms other than Facebook and Twitter. So if you could create something from scratch, what would you do? How would you make this better?
Well, as long as the idea is to bring people together towards a common truth, I think we need to establish that that's the goal because there are a lot of splintering going on right now into the dark web and with some, you know, apps that Mike, you've mentioned that are splintering in the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah. That was where my head first went is exactly what John just said is like the splintering, the new stuff is happening and it's people going even further into their dark corners. Right. So we like to punch Twitter and punch Facebook, like for every bad thing that happens on their platform. But like, what about when all these things are happening on encrypted Telegram groups and encrypted Signal groups? And, you know, I love both those products. They're great products, but like there are places that people can go where this stuff is even harder to like monitor and intercept. Right. And so I think that's our biggest immediate problem is we think what we're doing, you know, now that this terrible thing happened in the Capitol, we think what we're doing is we're sort of like snuffing out this fire with the bottoms of our boots, but we're really pushing it into corners. You know, we're pushing it into darker and darker corners. And so we have to be really careful about that. Getting back to your question, Todd, I think one of the really sort of pernicious things that happened over the last couple of years is the way these feeds are constructed. So often it's, especially on Facebook, often it is really, really hard to tell what an ad is and what an organic item is, right? And this is by design, right? So like we ran tests at Twitter with promoted tweets, like, hey, if we treat the promoted tweet this way and we put the word promoted tweet on top of it, how many people, you know, tap on the promoted tweet? If we remove the word promoted tweet and put it at the bottom, how many people click on it? If we scale the word promoted back to a light gray, how many people click on it, right? And really, all of that is sort of like testing how much does the person really think that this item is a legit item, right? And the more the person thinks it's a legit item and not an ad, the more likely they are to pay attention to it and click on it. And so if you look at some of these Facebook feeds that have spent years being tuned to somebody's preferences, I'll stop picking on conservatives and I'll just use liberals, right? So like let's say it's a feed of a really, you know, a really liberal person in New York City, and it's filled with I don't know, like news items about organic smoothies and panini sandwiches and like, yeah, whatever else people like to make fun of liberals for, I don't know. But you go down their feed and you'll see ads in there, but they are so well blended in with the rest of the content that people don't actually perceive that they are ads. And so, you know, the way this manifests itself is when news happens, essentially, companies will pay to have their stories inserted into stories, I use air quotes, inserted into other people's feeds. And so, you know, when something outrageous happens in the news, okay, yeah, maybe you see a couple comments about it from your friends on Facebook, and you see a couple legit links, and then you see a link to like a place you've never heard of, but hey, it's in there. So, you know, I'm going to click on it and see what it is. You read the story, it's made an impression on you, and you don't even realize that it's an ad. You don't even realize that somebody has paid to place that in your feed. And these things, it's so insidious, because the first time you see it, you're a little bit maybe skeptical of it. And then you see it again, like a day later, a week later, you click on it again and it's confirmation. And then you see something similar to it again and it's more confirmation. So you're like, wow, this crazy thing happened, but I've read about it four or five times, so it has to be true. And that is really, really scary. And that is sort of like the first way that I would kind of fix this problem is make sure that things that are not organically inserted into your feed, things that are inserted for money, are very, very clearly labeled, and in some cases, not even allowed.
There's an interesting comment that our guest last week, Margaret O'Meara, the historian from the University of Washington, said.
That's the problem with the curated news feed. It's great. It's perfect for selling ads. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing business model. It is not a great way to understand, get the full spectrum of what's going on in the world.
100%, 100%. Somebody on my team at Twitter said it perfectly. This was right around, I think maybe this was right after the 2016 election. He said, if every Facebook employee's feed looked like your standard right-winger's feed, this problem would have been fixed a long time ago. And it's totally true, right? Because as, you know, if we assume that most people, most engineers and designers and whoever who work at Facebook are like, you know, center or liberal or whatever, they're going to have, you know, maybe fairly reasonable feeds. What they're not seeing on a daily basis is what does the feed look like of somebody who is living in this echo chamber of truly fake news, of outrageous stories of, you know, pizza parlors and child porn and pedophilia and like all of these things that are designed to, you know, as Steve Bannon put it, flood the zone with SH star T. You know, what are those people, what is their daily experience look like? If you took a Facebook employee and you made that their daily experience, they would have said, whoa, 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 this is not good. We need to fix this.
Shouldn't the companies have at least had some sort of moderation and ability to identify that?
Yes.
Earlier?
But yes, for sure. But I will say the raw amount of content that makes it into Facebook and Twitter and all of these other social networks is so high. It is so, so high that the ability for companies to effectively moderate it is, it's almost impossible. And that doesn't let them off the hook. I mean, that almost puts them kind of like in a too big to, you know, too big to fail sort of thing is like, have they gotten too big, right? Chamath Palihapitiya was talking the other day and he said something like, you know, there should be a separate Facebook for every country. There should be a separate Twitter for every country. Because if you did it that way, these networks would at least be smaller and they would be more in tune with their country's kind of, you know, laws and ethics and local issues and things like that. But when you have essentially one company or two companies that are designed to serve the entire world's conversation, it really becomes a numbers issue very, very quickly. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of reports that come in every single day, probably hundreds of thousands of reports at this point that come in every single day that need to be looked at by human beings and adjudicated. And the really, really bad ones are actually easy, right? Like if somebody is being a Nazi in quite an explicit way on the platform, you kick them off, right? If somebody is threatening explicit physical harm, you kick them off. Like those are easy. It's the more borderline ones, you know, it's the ones where somebody is kind of just being a jerk, you know, or they might be abusing this person, but we need more background. Like, what's the backstory here? Okay, this person tweeted this to this person, and then this person replied, and then this person replied, and then they had a back channel conversation. Okay, now it's abuse. So there are so many cases like that need to be looked at that it's almost like because of the numbers that we're talking about, it's almost a problem where you can never really get the abuse down to zero, unfortunately.
Mike, looking back, you know, when you started Newsvine, what was the year you founded Newsvine?
2005.
So you think back to that era. And you think about this idea, and Todd and I were part of this too as journalists and early bloggers, and we were so excited about the power of people being able to comment on our stories and interacting with them. And I know Newsvine, this was very much built into your model, you know, the power of user-generated content and comments. When you think about the promise, I mean, there was really this thing, it was going to lift everybody up and people are going to have voices. And now you think of where we're at. Just what are your feelings on the whole concept that people have the ability to maybe be their own media entities and share content in this very, very public way, which going back to your original comments of back, you know, and when you were growing up, just the one newscaster where you were getting your information.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anybody listening to this podcast has not read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, you should read it because it is an amazing book that was written quite a while ago now that sort of very accurately describes the moment that we're in. It talks about the daily me. It talks about your newspaper being all about you and customized to you. And you know, in 2005, most of us thought that was kind of a good idea, right? And some people didn't, but there were quite a few of us who thought that was a good idea and that there really wasn't enough news in the world and that there were voices out there that needed to be amplified. And so that was kind of the goal is, look, there are so many voices out there. There are so many people that have great stories to tell, but they don't have a platform on which to tell those stories. That was kind of the genesis of Newsvine and what we wanted to provide. I would say now, though, we sort of have the opposite problem. Like now we have, you know, everybody has a voice. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has their own platform, multiple platforms. You can choose Twitter. You can choose Facebook. You can choose YouTube. You can choose Snapchat. You can like whatever you want, right? You can build a whole business around it for yourself. But the problem is that's too much information. And frankly, most of it doesn't matter. I think the site that is really nailing this for me the best right now is Axios. I think Axios has really provided a nice antidote to the world that we live in.
Totally agree. Todd and I are big fans. Yeah.
It's so good. I mean, it's like, look, give us your email address. Once a day, we'll send you a morning briefing and tell you what you need to know. And the morning briefing is just like some bullets. Very well written, very concise, link always links out to source material. And then you get on with your day, you know? And then if you want a PM briefing, you can sign up for that too. If you want like a, you know, a tech briefing, you can sign up for that too. But it's really designed with the mentality of we want to tell you everything you need to know in as little time as possible so that you can get on with the rest of your life. And so that I think is where the news needs to go. That's where we need to go as a people.
All right, we are going to take one more break. We will be right back with more about our discussion about the future of social media, startups, and everything else with Mike Davidson. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook. It's the GeekWire podcast. We are continuing our conversation about the state of the world and the state of social media. Mike Davidson is a tech and media industry veteran, previously the vice president of design at Twitter. We knew him back when he was just starting the citizen journalism startup Newsvine, which was later acquired by NBCNews.com. He's now VP of InVision, the digital product design software company. Hey, Mike, so if you were talking to a startup founder or even maybe thinking about founding a new startup yourself, I don't want to get you in trouble with your current employer, but what would you do in this space? Like, where are the opportunities taking into account everything that we've been talking about?
It's a really good question. I mean, I'll start off by saying there's a reason why I got on the news because I sort of didn't really like where it was heading. So I'm happy to sort of be out of it for a little while. But you know, every so often I do catch myself kind of thinking about new ways to sort of, you know, live in this world and create new services, better adapt to kind of where we are as a society. You know, I will say, you know, the idea of common ground, I think, is really, really important to me. I tweeted about this a couple months ago. So I'll retell the story really quickly. Right after the 2016 election, I was on a flight to New England to watch the Seahawks play the Patriots. So, you know, it was right after the 2016 election. So I was kind of like, you know, in the dumps, you know, not feeling good. And, you know, I sat down on the plane. It was going to be a 6-hour flight, right? And I sat down on the plane and the guy, there was no middle seat. There's nobody in the middle seat, but the guy, I was in the aisle and the guy in the window had a Seahawks jersey on. And, you know, I said hello and he said hello. And, you know, the doors closed and the plane got ready to take off. And, you know, we exchanged a few words and I could just tell by a couple of the ways he was answering my questions that he was a Trump voter, you know? And I kind of immediately was like, oh, great. Like, I've got 6 hours ahead of me, you know, talking to somebody who just voted for, you know, somebody who I can't believe won the 2016 election. But we ended up having a really, really good conversation. And it started off by talking about the Seahawks. And we spent the first, you know, 20 minutes of the flight talking about the Seahawks and talking about like what our game plan should be against the Patriots and talking about, you know, what we wanted to see out of our offense and what we thought of our draft class. And like, we spent that first 20 minutes building common ground. And all of that happened because he was wearing a Seahawks jersey and we were both Seahawks fans. And for the rest of the flight, we did talk some about politics and we did talk about other things, but it remained really civil and it remained productive. And I think I got some of my points across and I think I got some of his points across. But like at the end of the day, the reason that whole conversation occurred was common ground. And it was unrelated common ground, right? It was like, what do the Seahawks have to do with politics? Nothing, right? So I think that any serious effort to bring people together needs to start with common ground. And where can we start with that? We can start with, okay, well, we're all Americans. That's, you know, that's easy. That's, we have that in common. What other things do we have in common? Well, we kind of have this whole climate change thing to worry about. And, you know, maybe some people don't think it's real right now, but everybody's going to think it's real pretty soon, right? With each passing year, more and more people think it's real because you can see it, right? Miami will probably be underwater before all of us are dead, right? So, you know, you have things like climate change. You have things like the rise of China, which I think we should also all be on the same page about. You know, China, it's pretty clear to me, China is going to be the next world power. They will probably supplant us at some point as the world's number one superpower, or either that or it'll just be us and China, you know, dueling it out. So like, we should have that in common. So you can go down the list and find all these things that we probably should have in common with each other. And so that, like, I want to start from there. Like, whatever disagreements we have, I want to start with our common ground and I want to build deeper understanding of our individual problems with a respect for what our common ground is. So these conversations ideally start with common ground and then they move to more controversial topics. So let's talk about gun control, for instance. I am as anti-gun as it gets, you know, like I want to melt all the guns down, right? Like if I could melt all the guns down in the world, I would do it. Like I hate guns. But like, who am I to tell a woman, you know, who has maybe been attacked once in her life that she shouldn't or can't carry a gun in her house or even on her person, right? Like who am I to say that, you know? Like me as a white male living in a fairly safe neighborhood in Seattle, like I'm not exposed to the same dangers necessarily as she is. Only by hearing stories from people like that, like can I gain an appreciation of why gun control is actually a much more nuanced issue than I would like it to be, right? And you can do this for any topic, right? You can do this for manufacturing jobs. You can do this for you know, religion. You can do it for any number of things. I think most of us that have strong, unnuanced opinions about things just haven't spent the time with enough other people to know why these issues are so complex.
So is there a startup in there? Because that sounds great. That sounds great. It reminds me in part of what was happening during the Democratic presidential primaries, where he had Andrew Yang coming out and saying, hey, let's focus on the data. This is the number today. Where do we want the number to be tomorrow? And of course, Steve Ballmer, the former Microsoft CEO, and his USA Facts initiative is sort of the same way. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to say, okay, let's be empirical about this. Let's be quantitative. Like, where do we want things to be? And then once we agree on where things are today and where we want them to be in terms of the numbers, let's talk about the different policy things that we can do to get there. Maybe that's totally naive.
I think there's a lot of creative ideas in there for sure. I don't think any of them are like mainstream news sites, but like, you know, one thing I was thinking of the other day was, this is probably dumb, right? But like, I was thinking the other day, like the idea of like an app that paired you up with somebody who was nobody like, who was nothing like yourself. Like, take Mike Davidson from liberal enclave Seattle gets paired up with Joe Smith from Alabama.
I got a name for you. Pen pal.
Yeah. Pen pal. Yeah, there you go. Pen pal. Perfect. Perfect.
John, I love it.
Can we start a business, Mike? Let's all go into business.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. You got the name. Yeah.
We got the name. That's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah. Keep pitching, Mike. Go for it.
Yeah. So the idea is like, I wake up in the morning and I make a statement on the app to my pen pal. And my job is to make a statement that he agrees with. And then it pings over to him.
So it's like gamified a little bit.
Sort of. Yeah. 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 And then his job is to come back with a statement that I agree with. And then back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then at the end of the day, like, you can see, hey, how many things do we actually agree with? Okay. And then here's how different you guys are, you know? So like things like that, you know, where, and you can compare yourself against other people. So like, hey, I got paired with somebody from Michigan, or I got paired with somebody from Alabama. It doesn't scale very well, obviously, because it's like, you know, it's one-on-one interactions. But I really think that like one-on-one interactions, like these are the interactions that really change people's minds. You know, like people don't want to have their minds changed in public.
Imagine the data you could get, Mike, from all of that, that then I could do targeted advertisements directly to people based on their topics.
You're kicked out of the startup.
You're fired already.
Yeah, you're fired already on day zero.
Yeah, not to be controversial, but I do have a different and better name for this startup. Yeah. Words with Enemies.
Ooh. Todd, I love it. I love it. That's actually really good. So you know, there are ways to do that. Like, it's funny, I actually had something similar to this happen to me on this other app the other day. There's this new messenger app called Honk, which is, it's kind of crazy. It's a messenger app, but it's completely synchronous. So you can only talk to one person at a time, and they can see you as you're typing, and you can see them type. And so it's like a completely synchronous experience. And I happen to get the username at Mike. So I get all these random people just like, you know, friending me and wanting to chat. And like, I got this random guy from Georgia reach out like a week before the election. And he's like, hey, how's it going, Mike? I just wanted to like tell you, you got a cool username. And I was like, hey, how are you doing? How are you? Where are you from? He's like, I'm from Georgia. And we started talking about the election. You know, and that it was a serendipitous experience that I would have never sought out through a normal social app. But because of the particular weird mechanics of this one app, you know, it ended up putting me in touch with somebody who had an interesting conversation with.
I like this. Todd?
Yeah.
Thumbs up.
Words with Enemies.
Wordswithenemies.com is taken. Oh. However, in a stroke of startup genius, I have just registered wordswithenemy.es.
Ooh.
Words with Enemy. You see what I'm doing?
Yeah, there? Yeah. You went to the registry of Spain to get that.
Exactly.
I love it. Well done, Todd. Yeah, those .es domains come in handy every so often. I own a five sentences.es. It's a little project that I spent 2 hours on about 10 years ago. And I just checked the stats on it the other day, and it's still getting like 10,000 people coming to it a month. It's crazy.
Mike, we should give a shout out to your own Twitter feed, which I love tracking. Why don't you tell folks where they can follow you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Mike Industries. I don't, you know, I tweet a few times a day. Try not to pollute your feed with too much crap. But yeah, I'd love to chat with you on Twitter or anywhere else.
Mike, thanks for joining us. It's nice to go full circle with you here.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. It's great to see you guys.
Our podcast is produced by Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Thank you for listening to GeekWire. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
And I'm John Cook.
We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.